Recently, Tracy and I have been wading through the extras on the box set of The Hobbit, and we've enjoyed it very much. But one thing that came across as the actors spoke about their roles was that very often, as they prepared for a role, they had to think, or they worked out with the director, Peter Jackson, a backstory for the actor. Why, and this was important because really it gave motivation. Why did he act in the way he did? What was his backstory? What had happened to him to make him that kind of character? Now, that's quite important, isn't it? Because what you need when you're doing a film or a play is fully rounded characters. There's always something a bit irritating, or I find immensely irritating, if you feel there's an underwritten character or a character you just can't get their motivation. They don't seem to be consistent throughout the film or something like that. But the problem is here, as I was saying last week, is calamity has befallen Job and he doesn't know why. There's no backstory. And he cannot get his head round that. And what's happening now, this is good, is his friends turn up. And they realise that he has suffered immensely. I mean, he's lost everything, hasn't he? He's lost his family. He's lost all his possessions. He's literally, as he said, he's literally sat down on the an ash heap or the rubbish dump sort of effectively outside the town. And he's, if that wasn't bad enough, he's been afflicted by some ghastly skin disease, and his wife is literally sort of, is not being very supportive. She's saying, well, look, curse God and die. If this is what happens to you when you serve God, well, let's just let him put you out of your misery. But Job has taken a very sensible approach. He basically has said, well, why shouldn't we expect trouble to come? One of the accusations that Satan made about Job was he serves God for what he gets out of it. Take it away, Job won't serve you. He'll curse you. In fact, there's more going on there, isn't there? It's not just sort of a light wager. It's actually, you are not worthy of Job's worship. He serves you for what he gets out of it. And secondly, when Job passes that test with flying colours, Satan says, well, look, it's not a proper test. I'll tell you what. Affect his health. Then we'll see his true colours. But Job has not sinned, has he? There's something very strange about the book of Job. It's because essentially the test is passed in those first chapters. The first chapter one and the first part of chapter two. But now, and it's good, his friends turn up. They can see he's suffered. And they do the right thing, don't they? They share his sorrow with him. They realise it's not the time for words. They put dust on their heads. They go through the mourning rituals, which were obviously current at that time. And they sit for a time in silence. Because as it says here, they saw how great his suffering was. But then Job speaks. And effectively, the tone that we saw is this. To summarize it quickly, Job says, I wish I had never been born. Intense suffering brings despair. Job has now just focused on everything that's happened. And his history, the many good things have receded almost out of sight. He can't see them. Well, with the silence broken, the friends feel the need to speak up. Now, I'm going to, as I said, overview what they say, because I think this part of the book is important. I think it's mainly important because it prepares us for what's coming later. And some wise things are said. Don't get me wrong about this. Some wise things are said, but these are people trying to work out motivations. Some years ago, I went to the Young Vic and saw a production of Hamlet. And I swear it's one of the greatest experiences of my life. For about 4 hours, 20 minutes, it just went past in no time. I was enthralled by the play and I've been fascinated with it ever since. And there's a lot of theatre critics have tried to sort of get their head around the character of Hamlet. And it's basically this, what drives him? Does he lose the plot at some point? Is he mad? Or is there a method in his madness? Or is he more calculating than that? I personally think he loses it at one point, and the play clearly demonstrates that. But people have tried to work out his motivation, so every theatre critic will probably have a different take on it. And that's the problem here. Everyone's got a different take on what's happening. And it's going to get messy. It's going to get nasty, as we'll see. Well, seconds out, round one, we have three circles of speeches. Eliphaz is first to speak up. Now, he's sympathetic to Job. And he basically recognises there's so much good in Job. I think we saw that, didn't we, in the reading. Verse 4 of chapter 4, your words have supported those who stumbled. You have strength and faltering knees. You're a good bloke, Job. We know that. But his basic premise then comes out. Verse 7. Consider now who, being innocent, has ever perished. Where were the upright ever destroyed? As I have observed, those who plough evil and those who sow trouble reap it. Now, we're going to see this coming up in different times, different ways, again and again. And basically, it is this, isn't it? That the wisdom of the age is this. The evil will get their just deserts. Now, Eliphaz's counselling technique leaves a bit to be desired. He's had a mystical experience. And as it's a mystical experience, and obviously very important to him, it must have some bearing on Job's predicament. And he talks about this, doesn't he, in verse 12 of chapter 4, this rather strange thing where he is confronted by a spirit. It unnerves him. In verse 17, the spirit speaks, can a mortal be more righteous than God? Can a man be more pure than his creator? And he really applies this, doesn't he? And one of the things is, I think is important for us to note here, isn't it? When people are going through it, I'm sure I'm guilty of it, there is a great temptation to go to things that we think must be relevant to them because they were relevant to us. That may be the case, but so often it is not. And basically, as we continue on with what Eliphaz has to say, is that he's resorting to what the wisdom teachers would have said in that day and age. We get to verse 27. We have examined this, and it is true. So hear it and apply it to yourself. When we comes up in the conversations, they are referring to what wisdom teachers would have said in that day and age. So that's the wisdom of the age. But he sees suffering as instructive. As we saw in the second reading, blessed is the man, verse 17, whom God corrects. So do not despise the discipline of the Almighty. Now, the trouble with that again is it simplifies things far too much. There's a scene in Woody Allen film, Love and Death, which is a spoof reconstruction of Russian literature, which were very much war and peace, where they're going off to fight the French and they come across a battle and they see, you know, the Russian army's been wiped out. And after they sort of mused about this and sort of recognised friends, one of them says, "Oh, God is testing us." And Woody Allen says, "Well, if he's testing us, why can't he give us a written?" Now, that's often the case, isn't it? That's often how we feel. And it's wrong, isn't it, to apply everything that happens in some way to a direct influence of God on us. It's actually a situation that exists in the world. One Christian philosopher has said, we live in a world of ragged edges. And the point is this, Christians get caught in the crossfire. It's as simple as that. Well, what's Job's sort of reply to this? Well, Job's reply is interesting. In chapter 6 and verse 24 to 26, we see he appeals. You know, where have I gone wrong? Teach me, and I will be quiet. Show me where I've been wrong. How painful are honest words, but what do your arguments prove? You know, there's a sense where he's saying to Eliphaz, well, this is all very interesting, but I don't see how it relates to me. There's a problem there, isn't there? Next enter the fray is Bildad. Now, Bildad is far less sympathetic, and he wants to really sort of point out that the world is black and white as he sees it. Chapter 8 and verse 1 to 4. Bildad the Shuhite replied, "How long will you say such things? Your words are blustering wind. Does the God prevent justice? Does the Almighty prevent what is right? When your children sinned against them, he gave them over to the penalty of their sin." That's nasty, isn't it? Here's a man who's literally lost his family. And it's Job, it's your unruly children. Okay, maybe it wasn't you, Job, but there's a reason for what happened. God just doesn't sort of let things happen for the sake of them happening. Basically, there's a reason. Well, Job comes back at him. Chapter 9. Job hasn't denied, you see, that he's sinless. And we see that here. Then Job replied, "Indeed, I know it is true, but how can a mortal be righteous before God? Though one wishes to dispute with him, he could not answer him one time out of a thousand." Job actually knows his place before God, doesn't he? The problem's not there. Where is the problem? Well, the problem is this. Job doesn't quite know how to approach God. "He is not a man like me that I might answer him," verse 32, "that we might confront each other in court." One of the things that's quite noticeable in the conversations here is the name of God is El Hayim. It's God's creator. And that actually should alert us to something. It's not Yahweh, it's not God of the Covenant. There's a distance here, isn't there? These are people who are looking and trying to work out the problems in the dark, but they can't quite get their head around it. Job doesn't really know how to approach God. Well, up next is Zophar. He is one of the least sympathetic so far, though we'll see he's got, the others will give him a run for his money later. Verse 2 of 11, are all these words to go unanswered? Is this talker to be vindicated? He's a bit, you can see he's getting a bit edgy. He's been listening to what's going on, and he doesn't feel that his friends are really sort of taking Job to task. Verse 3, will your idle talk reduce men to silence? Will no one rebuke you when you mock? He's really not listening to Job very much, is he? Verse 4, you say to God, my beliefs are flawless and I am pure in your sight. Well, actually, Job hasn't said that. He's putting words into Job's mouth. There's another lesson there, isn't there? We do have to. When we're listening to people, and I think actually this is true with evangelism, when they ask a question, it could be a sincere, I know some people come out with daft questions just to be a nuisance, but sometimes they come out with a really sincere question, and we actually have to listen to that rather than sort of think and answer what we think they should be asking or saying. Well, Zophar's very much putting words in Job's mouth. Well, Job comes back at him. Chapter 12. Then Job replied, doubtless you are the people, and wisdom will die with you. But I have a mind as well as you. I'm not inferior to you. Who does not know all these things? And he goes on to talk about how he's suffering, isn't he? He really is not finding much sympathy here at all. Well, that's the first round, but second out, boing, as the bell goes off for round two. Eliphaz has another go. And basically, we'll see he's getting a bit more direct with Job here. Basically, what he says is, you reap what you sow. Verse 2 of 15, would a wise man answer with empty notions? Got two pages stuck together, sorry. Or fill his belly with the hot east wind. In other words, you're full of hot air, Job. Would he argue with useless words, with speeches that have no value? And then he goes on to say that really there's a sense in which Job is just getting what he deserved. Verse 20, all his days the wicked man suffers torment, the ruthless through all the years stored up for him. And then it goes on to basically say that the Lord makes it rough on those who are sinners. You reap what you sow, Job, and so there must be something in your past which isn't right. There's something you're not doing, or there's something you should have done. Now, this is a danger, isn't it? I think I told you this once before. My mother suffered quite a lot of ill health through the years. It was quite strange, really, in some ways. Her last years, she had very good health, but of course then she had this dementia that set in. But I remember she had really suffered, I think, quite patiently with her illness. But I'm sure someone who meant to be well-meaning gave her a book called The Blessing or a Curse. Mum read it and very much surmised that basically the unspoken message was that somehow her illness was all connected with some hidden sin in her life. Now again, you see, like Job, there's no way she'd claim to be sinless. But it's not as simple as that, is it? And there's a danger, isn't there, of sometimes saying people are going through bad times because of some hidden sin. Well, bad times do come upon us. There may be dry times for the gospel. spent, I think, a very profitable time. In the end of 1 Kings, as we looked at Elijah and we looked at Elisha at the start of 2 Kings. And these were mighty prophets, weren't they? My word. If you were writing their story, if you wanted to make a good story for them, you'd have people being, revival breaking out in Israel. Surely, you know, these were the kind of people who would turn people's hearts back to the Lord. And although at one point it almost looks like Elijah might, there's no revival in the northern kingdom. Yes, good things happen. The widow at Zarephath, a Baal worshipper, she acknowledges that God is the true God when she sees how God has worked through Elisha and Naaman. Again, a pagan comes to a knowledge of the Lord. But so often, doesn't it, where you want it to happen, it remains untouched. It's not as simple as they would sometimes pare things down to be. Job comes back at him. chapter 16, Job replied, "I've heard many things like these. Miserable comforters, all of you. Will your long-winded speeches never end? What ails you that you keep on arguing?" Really get the impression, what's Job saying? You lot are a fat lot of good, aren't you? You're really not giving me any help at all. You're not addressing the problem at all. Well, we move on. There's much more I could say about what Job says here, but I think in some ways that sums it up. Well, Job speaks on. Bildad, who we saw as very black and white, comes in for another go now. And again, it is very much the wicked get what's coming. Chapter 18, verse 1, Bildad the Shuhite replied, when will you end these speeches? Be sensible, and then we can talk. And his basic premise is this, verse 5, the lamp of the wicked is snuffed out. The flame of his fire stops burning. Why? Because God will put an end to it. It's as simple as that. And he says much more about that in that vein. Job comes back at him very sharply in chapter 19, verse 7. Job says, well, this isn't the problem. Though I cry, I've been wronged. I get no response. Though I call for help, there is no justice. Now, this is where Job now, and I think we can understand it, is perhaps being goaded to take a far stronger position than he might have done. And if there is a fault in Job, and we'll see this as it goes on, it is this. He's in the dark. He starts to surmise about God's purposes, and he does say some unwise things. There's no question about that. He continues just to give a sort of, because the trouble is we sort of lose where he is and what he's suffering. Verse 17, my breath is offensive to my wife. I'm loathsome to my own brothers. Even the little boys scorn me. When I appear, they ridicule me. All my intimate friends detest me. Those I love have turned against me. You know, his friends just don't come around anymore, do they? It's pretty desperate situation. He goes on, but then suddenly, and this is an incredible thing, it's a bit like a cloudy day with Job, isn't it? And suddenly the clouds breaks again, and he then suddenly sort of bounces up again. Verse 25, I know that my Redeemer lives, and in the end he will stand upon the earth, and after my skin has been destroyed, yet in my flesh I will see God. I myself will see him with my own eyes, I and not another. How my heart yearns within me. Now this is interesting because back in 19, back in chapter 16, verse 19, he has spoken about one who will act on his behalf. In 19, he mentions, even now my witness is in heaven, my active advocate is on high, my intercessor is my friend, as he pours out tears to God. On behalf of man, he pleads with God, as a man pleads for his friends. Now, all I can say about that is there have been absolutely pages written in commentaries on this. What exactly is going on here? And actually, I think we have to go towards the end of the book to pick that up, and we will. But Job, as indeed is often the case when we're very upset, there are moments where we bounce back up. There are moments where we have a confidence in God. There are moments again, though, where we will suddenly veer away from that again. Well, Zophar comes in again one more time. Chapter 20, verse 5. His premise again is simple. That the mirth of the wicked is brief. The joy of the godless lasts a moment. The wicked are always judged. That's just the way things are, Job. He will elaborate on that in that chapter. But Job comes back at him, and Job's comments are basically along the lines, to summarise, are you kidding? No, the wicked have it easy. The wicked have it easy. That's what Job says. You really haven't sort of looked at what happens here. Chapter 21, verse 7 to 9. Why do the wicked live on? Growing old, increasing in power. They see their children established around them, their offspring before their eyes. Their homes are safe and free from fear. The rod of God is not upon them. Their bulls never fail to breed. Their cows never miscarry. They send forth their children as a flock. Their little ones dance around and about. They spend, verse 13, years in prosperity. They go down to the grave in peace. Yet they say to God, leave us alone. We have no desire to know your ways. Very much like the plight of the psalmist in Psalm 73. Very much echoes these words. Who, verse 15, is the Almighty that we should serve him? What would we gain by praying to him? And then Job says, but I distance myself from that. Verse 16. But their prosperity is not their own hands. So I stand aloof from the counsel of the wicked. Job doesn't wish to be like them. He still remains very of some real integrity in the sense that's not me. Even if they do get off, that's not me. Well, Eliphaz comes up. It's getting quite interesting now. I think the sheer fatigue's setting in. Zophar drops out at this point in the contest. We've just got Eliphaz and Bildad here. Eliphaz has gone full circle. This is unbelievable, but this is the way people get when they get in an argument. Eliphaz, chapter 22, verse 9. Just listen to this. And just again, think what he said. I'm just going to read chapter 4, verse 4. This is what he said to start with when he was addressing Job. Your words have supported those who stumble. You have strengthened faltering knees. Job, you're a good bloke. Listen to this, what he now says now. Is it for your piety that he rebukes you and brings charges against you? Is not your wickedness great and your sins endless? He's gone from Job, you are basically, you're a very good bloke, to you are one of the wickedest men that have ever lived. He goes on, I can't believe this. You know, here we are. You, verse 6. You demanded security from your brothers for no reason. You stripped men of their clothing, leave them naked. You gave no water to the weary. You withheld food from the hungry. Though you were a powerful man owning land, an honoured man living on it. You sent widows away empty-handed and broke the strength of the fatherless. Job, you're terrible. But again, there's a warning here, isn't there? And there is a warning. I've said this before, and I know some of you, I know Gilbert said he sympathised with me on this. I have to keep a lid on it when I'm talking to Jehovah's Witnesses. There's a real danger, isn't there, that you just get so forthright in your argument. And we do have to listen, don't we? Eliphaz hasn't listened. And Eliphaz has just done what we can easily do, and this is we can blow things so often when we're evangelizing by strengthening and sticking our heels in and becoming so fast frightened literally in someone's face. Well, he's doing that, but he's now completely full circle. He's misjudged Job completely. As I said, you know, it gets worse and dirtier by each round that goes on. Job basically comes back. In a sense, he's almost ignoring some of what Eliphaz has said. Chapter 23. This is pitiful, isn't it? If only, and verse 3. If only I knew where to find him. If only I could go to his dwelling. I would state my case before him and fill my mouth with arguments. I would find out what he would answer me and consider what he would say. The problem for Job is heaven's silent. I suspect the other part of his problem is his friends are not. Job really wants the counsel of God, doesn't he? It's a tough one. Verse 10, but he knows the way I take. When he has tested me, I shall come forth as gold. Again, there's a schizophrenic nature to Job's thing. He has accused the Lord of being unfair, but he basically believes in the goodness of God still. He believes God will answer him. But he also realises that God, as we were saying last week, God actually holds the key to this. Verse 16 of chapter 23. God has made my heart faint. The Almighty has terrified me. Yet I am not silenced by the darkness, by the thick darkness that covers my face. Now, I think that's important, isn't it? Because, you see, as I was saying last week, we don't want to get dualistic. You know, the trouble with Christians who believe that everything bad happens of the devil and everything good happens of God means that we look at a world and we see that God is not doing very well, and that cannot be true because God is sovereign. We saw last week, didn't we, that God had Satan on a leash. Satan could go so far, but he could not go further. He couldn't take Job's life. God actually is in control, and in some ways, Job acknowledges that. Well, Bildad's speech is the shortest speech of all in chapter 25. It actually starts very well. He gives God his proper place. Dominion and awe, verse 2, belong to God. He establishes order in the heights of heaven. That's fine. But then basically, I can't help thinking this is aimed at Job. He basically then compares man to him. How much less, verse 6, but how much less man, who is but a maggot, the son of man, who is only a worm. In a sense, Bildad is reduced to name-calling at this point. Job, you're a maggot and a worm. And I can't help thinking that that is aimed at Job. Job basically says, thanks a lot, sarcastically. 26, verse 2. Then Job replied, how you have helped the powerless, how you have saved the arm that is feeble, what advice you have offered to one without wisdom, what great insight you have displayed, who has helped you utter these words, and whose spirit spoke from your mouth. Well, there's sarcasm, if ever there was sarcasm. Job is at a very, very low ebb. He goes on, verse 5. The dead are in deep anguish, those beneath the waters, and all that live in them. Death is naked before God, destruction lies uncovered. He spreads out the northern sky over empty space. He suspends the earth over nothing. Now the problem is this, as we step back from all this, is that man's wisdom always falls short. We see that. It's fickle. It digs its heels in. It's stubborn. It makes assumptions where assumptions are not to be made. It literally, as we saw, put words into Job's mouth. It drew conclusions which were completely erroneous. And we'll see soon, next week, that the writer, and I believe it is the writer, there's much musing over this as to how chapter 28 fits into the book of Job. The writer Beckley says, well, look, we've had a lot of stuff going on. We've had a lot of stuff said. We actually need to step back. And I think we'll find next week that chapter 28 is like opening a window and getting some fresh air. And by golly, after we've been through these speeches, we need it. The wisdom of man will fall short, but God's wisdom, as we'll see next week, doesn't. But rather interesting, Job now directs his comments towards God. He pretty much stops talking to his friends. He keeps talking, but it's less to them. Now, I can't say in some ways I blame him. He hasn't had much comfort from them. He's talking to God now. And here's the problem. A bit like the critics who try to work out what Hamlet's motivation is in that great play of William Shakespeare, Job now thinks he's got God worked out, and he makes some judgments. And one of them is this: God is unjust. Chapter 27, Job continued his discourse, verse 1. As surely as God lives, who has denied me justice, the Almighty, who has made me taste bitterness of soul. That's one of the conclusions he comes to. He does what is often the case when we're suffering difficult times. He looks back to a better time. That's very tempting, isn't it? Verse chapter 29, Job continued his discourse. How I long for months good and gone by, for days when God watched over me, when his lamp shone in my head, and his light, by his light I worked through darkness. God was there for him. God was his guide. Those were the good times in his relationship with God. He goes back, doesn't he? He falls back on his goodness, his piety. He says basically, I was a good person. You know, I was a good person. Verse 7, people respected me. When I went to the gate of the city and took my seat in the public square, the young men saw me and stepped aside. The old men rose to their feet. The chief men refrained from speaking and covered their mouths with their hands. The voices of the nobles were hushed. Their tongues stuck to the roof of their mouth. Whoever heard me spoke well of me, and those who saw me commended me, because I rescued the poor who cried out for help, the fatherless whom none to assist him. The man who was dying blessed me. I made the widow's heart sing. I put on righteousness as my clothing and justice as was my robe and turban. My eyes were blind, the eyes of the blind, the feet of the lame. I was father to the needy. I took up the case of the stranger. I broke the fangs of the wicked and snatched victims from their teeth. Basically, again, he appeals to his goodness. And then he looks in a pitiful way to his present state. Chapter 30. But now they mock me, men younger than I, whose fathers I would have disdained to put with my sheepdogs. He goes on, verse 9. And now their sons mock me in song. I have become a byword among them. You can see it, can't you? There he is, sitting on the rubbish heap at the edge of town. And the youths and the adolescents say, look at Job. And everyone's saying, look at Job. That's what happens when you are a sinner. That's what happens when you harbour a secret sin. And of course, that unfortunately is the wisdom of the age, and that is the approach Job's friends have taken. Now, the interesting thing is this. There's a good and a bad here. Job is looking to God. And that's always the way we should look. But as we see at the end there, he's trusting a bit too much in his own righteousness. He actually started off by saying, look, I know a man can't be righteous before God. His friends complain that he's basically saying, well, I've done nothing wrong. He's not said that. Job's never said he's not a sinner. But rather now, and perhaps again, this is the trouble, isn't it? When we're under pressure, or when we have gossip about us, we entrench our position. He's lost the balance, and he starts to sort of make points of his own righteousness and plead from his own righteousness. Chapter 31, I made a covenant with my eyes not to look lustfully at a girl. For what is man's lot from God above? Is the heritage of the mighty on high? Is not ruin for the wicked, disaster of those who do wrong? Does he not see my ways and count my every step? In other words, look, God owes me because I haven't done what I should not do. He continues, doesn't he? Now, as I said, we skipped a bit ahead of ourselves. We'll come to the wisdom and how wisdom is measured next week, and it will be a breath of fresh air, I believe, after this sermon. But the thing is, of course, we have to understand, don't we, that we are in an age where we are given the grace of God. We need to understand that. Now, actually, Job will experience that in the end. He will see just how far God's goodness will go. But that's another sermon. But we have to realise as well that our righteousness will get us so far. It might get us a good reputation among man, but that's as far as it goes. It can't get us, or in any sense, give us credit with God. No, we are in a more privileged position than Job, because we've been given something richer, and that is the righteousness of God. 2 Corinthians 5, verse 21. I'm sure you knew this was coming. God made him who had no sin to be sin for us, that we might become the righteousness of God. We live in a day and age, don't we, where we don't have to, and we shouldn't, and we should realise we do not have to plead, and shouldn't plead, in our own righteousness. Job had nothing else to do, in some sense, which is why perhaps he falls into the trap of pushing that line a bit too far. But we don't, do we? Because, you see, we've had one who's become sin for us. We have the Lord Jesus Christ. We are vindicated. We now actually have, don't we? We have that one, the advocate in heaven. The one who stands before the Father's throne. The one who pleads our case. The one who, if we do sin, we can go to and can plead forgiveness. And he will present our case. And he has given us a righteousness. I don't know how it's going to work out on the day of judgment. I don't know how it's going to work. I don't know the mechanics of it exactly. I know God will judge those who are his and bring them into wonderful fellowship with him. I don't know how it will work, but I always imagine it will be like this. When we stand on that great and dreadful day, Jesus will come and say, and stand in front of us and say, this one's mine. He's got my righteousness. Isn't that a comfort? He has no accusation against him because his sins are forgiven. I don't know how the mechanics will be, but I imagine it might be something like that. Now, what a joy that is. Job had to plead, as I said, in his time and his understanding. And because I think, you know, if he makes mistakes, poor guy, he's been goaded by his friends, something rotten, hasn't he? Job appeals to his righteousness. We can appeal to something greater, the righteousness and the forgiveness and the grace that is found in Jesus Christ. Job will experience some grace from God, but we have something far richer. Let's rejoice in that and pray.